saving for my birthday. In 29 years, my father hadn't gotten me anything. This birthday, he handed me the bottle and said, "You made me 30. My job's done." But I didn't think of my father as I drank. I thought of my way up there in Harlem wearing new dresses and walking new streets. Getting off work each day and taking home the new subway. Thought about how she got hot and didn't say much. And I'd yell about the government and her reptilians. And in her silence, I found something to fight. Things like that used to matter, but I couldn't remember why. Even if I never had to worry about her, where she was, and who she'd gone there with, that didn't seem like enough then. But it does now. I was drunk and hungry and thought of food my new home didn't have, and how we used to walk through the village for coffee, on the way to Vietnamese kitchens, and sometimes see Patty Smith on her stoop, or rare breeds of hunting dogs in the park. I remember her feet didn't reach the ground if she sat against the back of the bench, and she crossed them at the ankles and swung them like a kid on a swing. Like a kid who still knew there was all the time left in the world, and nothing was ever going to go wrong. There were many days like that, and some weren't like that at all.
This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Scott Lodotti. Scott, great having you back on the show.
Thanks for having me again, guys.
And I'm also joined here with Pill Eater and Cartrell Payne, the Adventure Kid.
Hey there, Scott.
Hey, what's up, man?
Scott, your book we talked about last time, Play the Devil, that's now being translated into Italian.
Yeah, this girl, Ada, hit me up on Instagram. We both love, like, Pete Doherty and Serge Gainsbourg and stuff. And she asked me if she could translate into Italian. So she's working on that right now and then going to pitch it to Italian publishers. And hopefully we get, like, some European action.
How does the publishing process work? So you published it via your own... Was this your own publishing company? You can publish the same book through multiple publishing companies?
Well, no, it was published by Kubowa, so Pablo does Kubowa.
Oh, yeah, Pablo Oster.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you guys had him on a little while ago.
Yes. And Josh, too, so.
Right, yeah. But Pablo does Kubowa, which is what Play the Devil and Hawaiian Shirts came out on. So, I mean, I just had to get permission from him to have somebody in Italy publish it, but he didn't care. Normally, you would need to get lawyers and your publishing company would need to sign contracts and all that other stuff. But luckily, he's just like an indie guy and just cares about art. So it's no big deal.
Do you recommend getting a publishing company, or what are your thoughts on self-publishing? Is it primarily for the prestige of having your name associated with it, or do publishing companies play a big role in promotion?
Well, it depends. I mean, if you look at Tom Young, he's got 60,000 Instagram followers now. I mean, he doesn't need a publishing company anymore. It depends. I don't know. If you can know how to navigate social media, you could do it without a publishing company. It certainly helps. If you want to submit your book to like movie houses and stuff like that to try to get a script made, it looks better to have a publisher. But they don't care about that. I mean, they just want to know that people are going to see it. So if you have 60,000 Instagram followers, then that means a lot more, I think, than a publisher. Usually what happens is like you'll get a $2,000 advance or something like that from your publisher, if it's like a bigger publisher, but then you have to pay all that back before you start getting profits off your book. And I mean, barely anybody ever recoups that. So you're kind of stuck in this limbo then, and then you're damaged goods. If you just publish with an indie guy and then, he promotes the book to his followers or, there's a little built-in network, but you kind of can come and go as you please, and you don't have to answer to anybody. So I like that a lot more.
Oh, yeah. So what influenced your poetry? Like, who's your favorite poets?
I like beat poetry a lot. Jim Carroll's my favorite poet. He's not exactly a beat poet, but he's kind of in the same school, I guess. When I was like 16, I saw the Basketball Diaries, and I wanted to know more about the guy who wrote it. And after reading his poetry, I decided that like I could also be a poet. I'd only ever read like rhyming poems before that they made us read in school, and I didn't really like those. But Jim Carroll kind of showed me you could write current things that don't have to be like steeped in metaphor and just subtext all over the place. You could just write straightforward and it could still be amazing. So I try to emulate him when I write.
And your next project is a new book of poetry, which is going to be released in the fall.
Yeah, so Kuboa will be putting that out as well. That'll come out around probably like in mid-October. It's going to be called Yeti Funeral. It's going to have 50 poems. I'm really excited about it. I've been working really hard every day to just like comb through each poem and try to get it perfect. And I'm like 99% done. I'm writing one poem as a tribute to my dog. And it's taking a really long time because I'm trying to like get it perfect and be the best poem of all time. And like something that everybody who's ever had a dog could read and like really connect with. So that's the one that's taking me like the longest. It's the longest it's ever taken me to write a poem before. So
it's one long poem or a book of multiple poems?
No, well the book will have 50 poems. It's just poem number 50 is the one about my dog that's taken me forever to write. I've rewritten it 100 times.
Is there a kind of a overall cohesive theme that brings all these poems together?
No, it'll probably be like my first book of poems just all over the place about dogs and girls and aliens. I'm back in New York City, so that's kind of influencing a lot of the poems. A lot of them are about walking around the streets of Manhattan. It's going to be called Yeti Funeral, like the Sasquatch, but Yeti.
What have been some of your experiences walking around the streets of New York, and what have you written about?
Well, New York is, I mean, every day it changes because the rents go up every single day. So you could walk around a block and from month to month, it's all completely different stores. Neighborhoods get gentrified overnight. So it's just like a constantly evolving organism that's always fascinating. And there's always like, no matter how expensive New York gets, there's just like a layer of grime on like every street and building that like never gets washed off. I mean, you could still go to the Port Authority now and get offered blowjobs in the bathroom and then, you know, put out in the street like a celebrity will be getting out of a Navigator or something. It's a complete dichotomy, and that kind of exists on every block in New York. It's like chaos and filth, and then the richest people in the world. Mm-hmm.
You were briefly lived in L.A. What were some of your observations about L.A. and did you have a favorite particular part?
Yeah, I was in L.A. for 6 months. That's where I was living the last time I talked to you guys. I was working at the Standard, which is a hotel downtown. When I moved there, I just met this guy off Craigslist, and I moved to Hollywood not really knowing anything about L.A. I really didn't like the neighborhood of Hollywood, but I did like downtown L.A. a lot. It reminded me – it was the neighborhood that most reminded me of New York, I guess. L.A. is much more dangerous and much scarier to be out in the streets at night than New York, than I've ever felt in New York. But the Mexican food in L.A. obviously is the best. But I don't know. I would go to work every day and kind of just like walk around downtown. And there was abysmal poverty on the streets. And it was really scary at night when I would leave. But if I moved back to L.A., I would certainly move downtown rather than a fake neighborhood like Hollywood.
Are you talking about the area like around like Broadway?
Yeah. So the hotel was on Flower and I can't remember the name of the side street now, but yeah, like that whole strip of Broadway with all those like broken down old theaters that are now churches or like weird homeless communities that exist inside of them. That part of LA was very cool, and I found it like very inspirational. It was like a Art Deco nightmare, and I've never seen anything like it before.
On Broadway, there's this place, I forget. Oh, the Bradbury Building where they filmed Blade Runner. Have you been there?
Yeah, somebody took me for a walk past that because I went into work and I was like, I cannot believe this is what downtown Los Angeles looks like. Like, of all the parts of a city to like revitalize and like make hipster, that somehow downtown was like the last one for that to happen to. And like, as I was saying this, somebody was like, oh, I got to take you and show you Skid Row. I got to take you where they, you know, film Blade Runner. You know, it's crazy. So that was all really fascinating to go and look at.
What are your thoughts on the hipster scenes in LA and in New York, especially Williamsburg? Do you see the hipster culture as something authentic, or do you see it as kind of just another commercial fad?
Well, Williamsburg has like graduated from hipster to like the uppest echelon of yuppie. Like, there's not even we're in a post-hipster New York, and it's the worst crowd imaginable. They refer to Williamsburg as the bubble now, like real estate agents. And you get off the subway at Bedford, it's like it's just couples with strollers and endless Whole Foods, and you can't even walk around. It's just packs of children, and everybody's smiling and walking, you know, like yellow labs and stuff. It's like Disney World has been moved right into Brooklyn. It's horrible. So all the cool stuff that, like, we would go to Brooklyn when I was in high school to like warehouse punk shows and stuff, and that's all gone. It's all been moved out to like Bed-Stuy and Bushwick, I guess, but even that, like, the hipster thing is kind of done. It's just you need so much money to live in New York now. You have to be like a lawyer or, you know, a buyer for a company or something like that.
Yeah, you've got a point. I mean, I was reading a book one time about how the Lower East Side used to be back in the 70s and the 80s, and they said it was filled with trash and heroin needles. But nowadays, it's basically the safest place to be in Manhattan.
Yeah, it's a major bummer, man. They used to have like C Squat down there where all the punks went. You know, like Tompkins Square Park was just like a heroin haven. I mean, everybody, like Sid Vicious would go there and get his heroin. Everybody would just be friggin' doped out. But with that, you get record stores on every corner. You get cheap bars. You get people from Ohio that want to be painters. And you can't have that anymore. It sucks.
I guess I would say that people, because you can't do Manhattan or even for that matter in California, there's always that next big thing city. And of course, everyone knows Portland, you know, north of the West Coast. Even there's a show called Portlandia. You yeah. know, there's and you could say the same for New York, where it's Philadelphia. It's not New York, but certainly it's a sister city, right? And you could do your thing there, or at least, you know, there's always these surrogate places people can go, and people are always looking, I guess, for the next big thing.
Yeah, I haven't found that out here. A lot of people right around, like, 2004 went to Philly and were doing some cool stuff in Philly. I haven't heard so much about Philly anymore. A couple people have, like, filtered up to the Bronx, but I don't know. As far as, like, that you take the train. I visit my cousin all the time in Portland, Maine, and that's a cool city. It's got an infrastructure. There's nobody there. It's cheap. And in between New York and Maine, you pass through like Bridgeport, Connecticut, New London, Connecticut, you know, Lowell, Massachusetts. And these are all enormous cities that were built to like, and you pass them and you're reminded that like once upon a time, something great was happening here. But no, as far as I know, nobody's been moving out of New York yet. We just work more.
Yeah, you know, they say that Detroit is the new city to go to if you want to, you know, experience grime and grime and dirt.
I haven't been to Detroit, have you?
No, but I heard that it's filled. It's a terrible place to live. There's wild dogs everywhere, and the city is filled with corrupt politicians.
Yeah. Well, actually, you know, we had – so Newark, New Jersey is right across the river from New York and one of the old grand cities of America. And like 4 years ago, we all – not all of us, but like 30 of us moved to Newark. And it was awesome for a little while. We all lived in one huge factory building and – you know, it was just like everybody was drunk and on drugs, and it was like a hippie kind of thing. Like this one girl, Sharon, would make us food every night, and we'd all like play music and wear tie-dye shit. And Newark was kind of on like a verge of a renaissance. And then I don't know what Chris Christie did, but somehow him and the mayor got together and they cut the police force in half and did all this corrupt stuff. And almost overnight, like the crime went crazy. Everybody we lived with got mugged, and some of them are still there, but most of us have left. It just it got really dangerous.
You recently traveled to Cuba. This was right after the travel ban was lifted. Can you talk about that experience?
Yeah. So I guess we should have some context first, because I didn't know most of this before I went there. But every president since Kennedy has voted to continue this stupid embargo we have with Cuba, right? So we never had an embargo with Russia, who was our enemy, but we've had one since the 60s with Cuba. And the reason that everybody keeps signing this embargo is because of that one voting base in Miami. All those Cubans who fled went to Miami, and you know you can't win the presidency without winning Florida. So that group of Cubans hates Castro, and to get that voting base in the pocket, the politicians every year vote to have the embargo in place, and then the Cuban community in Florida votes for them and gets all excited, and then, you know, we starve out another couple thousand Cubans down in the home country. So I think that's what's happening now, because now that Trump and Tillerson want to, you know, put the embargo back on and make it really strict. I think it's because they know they're going to need every vote they can get in 4 years to get reelected. So anyway, but Obama lifted one part of the embargo. So we weren't allowed to travel there or spend money there, right? Spending money was the big deal. So what Obama lifted was we were allowed to travel there, but we weren't allowed to spend any money that got taxed, because then it would go to the communist government. So you're allowed to fly there. So we got our visas in the airport. We flew there. We didn't know we weren't allowed to spend any money, and we didn't know our ATM cards wouldn't work in the banks. So we brought $200 in cash with us, blew it all in the first 2 days, and then didn't have any money for 3 days. So we were asking people on the street to buy us food. My uncle went there for the sole purpose of buying cigars. He couldn't buy any cigars, so he was flipping out the whole time. Finally, we got a hold of like the United States Embassy in Cuba. And when we called them and we told them we were in Cuba, the guy in the embassy flipped out. He was like, "What are you doing in Cuba? You're not allowed to be in Cuba. You have to come to the embassy right now and give us your name. We need to start a case." So we just hung up on him, and we were like, "Oh shit! Like we got to get out of Cuba." Like we didn't realize that every time we spent any money, we were breaking the embargo laws. So by the time we called the embassy, we had broken like 700 embargo laws. So what we ended up doing was we got a hold of my aunt in New Jersey, who wired money to some Cuban national in Miami, who was able to transfer the money to the guy who was running our Airbnb in Cuba, and then he was able to give us money. So we had money by the end of the trip, but it was really scary for a while.
Yeah, man. I mean, you could have ended up in Leavenworth for doing stuff like that.
Yeah, especially with this new administration. But what they're saying to justify putting the embargo back on is that Cuba has human rights abuses and their people aren't free and all that stuff, which is a total lie. Everybody in Cuba can walk around, wear whatever they want, say whatever they want. They all have cell phones. The government gives them internet ID cards so they can go to the parks or wherever there's Wi-Fi and use their cell phones. So they're all on Facebook and Instagram and stuff. They're not oppressed like that in any way. And when you think about it, it's like the people there are super proud of their government. I mean, their government told the United States to F itself, and they won. They fought back against the Americans, and they won. So the people there have an insane amount of pride in Castro and stuff like that. And this is stuff that you'd never hear about back in the United States. You think they're all, you know, it's like North Korea or something. It's not. They're totally.
Oh, man, North Korea is terrible.
Yeah. So we just get all this bad, you know, propaganda, and it's not like that. I mean, Cubans live longer than us. They have 100% literacy rate. Nobody's hungry in Cuba. There's no Baltimores. There's no Detroits in Cuba. Everybody gets food every day. They're all college educated. I mean, there's some trade-offs. Like, they don't, you know, you can't go to a Reebok and buy 700 different kinds of Nikes, but you also don't have to worry about getting a job, and your kids are all going to go to college and get educated. So, oh, and they can all go to the doctor for free anytime they want.
Yeah, and the crime is pretty low there, too.
No crime, man. We were drunk as hell walking around at 4 a.m., like, dropping stuff. We could have been picked clean 100 times, and nobody ever did anything.
Did you have any interaction with, like, the Cuban police or government officials?
No. There's like the old revolutionary, well, they're not old, they're young, but they're in like the revolutionary uniforms on like every corner. And a couple of times I asked them for directions or where I can get beer and stuff like that. And they were totally helpful. So no crime, no extortion, no, like, no policeman pulled us over and demanded bribes. There was none of that.
What were some of your observations on the city of Havana itself, the culture and the architecture? Do they still have the old cars from like the 50s?
Yeah, that's not even a tourist thing. They almost only have those cars from the 50s. There's thousands of them. If you go on the highway, that's almost all you see. Most of the bad images we have of Cuba are from the 90s when they were coming over in bathtubs and fleeing in droves. It was because Russia was almost completely propping them up. So giving them food, giving them gasoline, stuff like that. And once Russia collapsed overnight, Cuba went completely bankrupt and people were starving. But people still bring that up as an example of like why Cuba sucks. But I mean, that was 30 years ago. That was when I was a baby, you know, like think about anything 30 years ago, the whole world's different.
Yeah, I mean, you got a point.
So they were, it obviously has been poor. You know, it's a giant old Caribbean port city. I was in Havana most of the time. We left Havana to go see where Hemingway wrote The Old Man and the Sea. It's like a fishing village outside of Havana. But other than that, I mean, there's building going on everywhere. There's cranes, there's people, you know, shoveling old streets out of the way to put new ones down. It's poor. It's certainly poor, but it's not, like I said, it's not Baltimore. It's not Newark. It's and everybody's happy, and it looks like things are on the up and up.
Have you ever have you ever seen the movie Hemingway in Cuba? I remember.
Yeah, that was the worst movie I've ever seen.
I saw that in theaters, and nobody was in the theater. It was just me and my brother. And like, we wanted to see a movie, and we saw that. And it's like, you brought that up, and I just thought that was interesting about Hemingway. I mean, did you have intentions to go to Cuba to see Hemingway's stuff or, you know, memorial ground? Or
yeah, well, I had been told that I needed like documentation for a reason to go to Cuba, that we weren't just allowed to go. And I actually did have to present this in Newark Airport on the way home. But so I had Pablo write a whole letter about how my uncle and I were like researching a biography on Hemingway that Kubo was going to press, which it was never going to get written, or we weren't going to do. But I was like, Pablo, if, you know, I need an excuse to go to Cuba, man. So I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't say this over the radio, but in possibility of breaking all kinds of international law, Pablo stepped up and wrote me a letter.
You were also involved with Occupy Wall Street. You even got arrested during that. When this was back in the early part of it.
Yeah, it was 2011, yeah. Because it kind of fell apart in 2012 as a movement. But yeah, I mean, at first it was like, they set up camp in Zuccotti Park, and I was living in Newark at the time, so I would take the PATH train just under the river, and it sends you out where the World Trade Center used to be. So that's about a block from Zuccotti Park. Yeah, we just stayed. I would stay in the park for 2 or 3 days at a time, and go back to Newark and shower, and then go back to the park, and it was beautiful for a while. The media tried to turn it into this, the kids just want to have Woodstock, and it's because they don't want jobs or whatever. But especially at the beginning of Occupy, it was it attracted so many people because, I was in a democratic socialist kind of group in college, and there was a lot of those, but there was also
a PSL, Party of Social and Liberation.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So you would have been there,
well, Scott, what I think broke apart the Occupy Wall Street movement is that the same thing what happened to SDS in the 60s. You had too many people with too many ideas, and they couldn't agree on anything.
That's actually a perfect point, man. I was just going to say that. Like, in the beginning, it attracted so many people initially because, if you were mad about mountaintop removal, you and your group came there to protest. If you were mad about, prisoners not getting enough books to read in jail, you went there. So it was like every group that was angry about the government, about anything, joined together. And it worked out for a little while. But also the problem was the media did a great job of making all of us look like we had no idea why we were there, because they were like, oh, they don't have a message. They don't have a message. It's just, the media couldn't sum up in one sentence that it was all messages. And like the message was, our government has failed us. But obviously the New York Times isn't going to put that on their front page. So, they made us like, we're too liberals, we're hippies, we're communists, we're, we're stoners. We don't know why we're there. Yeah. So yeah. And Rudy Giuliani came out and he was like, well, I don't know what they want. They just want to have Woodstock down there. So that initially is what attracted so many people, but I think is also what broke it up. They, I mean, there was no leader there, but I think we're about to enter a time, hopefully eventually, where there isn't one leader. I mean, why do we still need one leader for everything?
Oh, so are you an anarchist, or what is your politics?
As I get older, I get much closer to anarchy. I'm definitely a socialist. I don't know if people left to their own devices could end up doing anything but killing each other. But I don't think that a government is the answer either, or especially a government that was invented when people were still riding horses to work and using ink quill pens. That we still have that same government, and that's insane.
How did you get arrested at Occupy Wall Street?
It was during one of the mass arrests. It was in Times Square. So it was after that Brooklyn Bridge arrest that, like 900 people got arrested. I was arrested with probably 300 people. But yeah, it was just like one night, for whatever reason, everybody descended on Times Square. We shut Times Square down for like 3 hours, and the NYPD rode up like the Roman army on these giant horses, and we're just running back and forth on these horses, running people over, swinging bats around like gladiators. A lot of people got hurt that night. And basically the NYPD just beat their way through the middle of a crowd, separated us, half on one side of the street, half on the other. And while they stomped and hit the one side with clubs, they threw a net over my side and just maced everybody and beat us with bats until we were all bleeding. And I had long hair at the time, so my hair was covered in mace. Every time I moved, my eyes would start burning again. And then they zip tied us, and which a zip tie, man, hurts so much more than handcuffs. It just slices through your wrist. So all of our wrists were bleeding. They put us in a paddy wagon and took us downtown, and they left us in jail for like 16 hours or something crazy. We just sat in a jail cell for all night while the NYPD would insult us.
Is this Rikers Island or just a police holding cell?
No, it's actually, have you ever heard of the Tombs?
No.
Okay, the Tombs are like a famous New York jail. They've been around forever. Anybody you ever read about who back in the day got arrested in New York got brought to the Tombs. But it's at One Police Plaza. So it's down right on the border of Chinatown. That's where they kept us. I mean, they never charged us with anything. They just cleared the streets. And the NYPD builds a couple million dollars into their budget every year so they could do illegal stuff like this. And then they just pay it out when they get caught. So everybody who got arrested is like a part of a lawsuit. We're probably all going to get like $200 someday. But I was living with this girl, Cecily McMillan, who became the face of Occupy. And we were living together in Brooklyn at the time. And the NYPD in March of that year, like, grabbed her by the breast, and when she fought back, they beat her so bad she had a seizure. It was on tape, and they brought her to Rikers Island. They kept her in Rikers Island for like 80 days, and they charged her with a felony for assaulting a police officer because she like elbowed the guy as he was like grabbing at her breast, and she ended up getting convicted of felony because the judge wouldn't let the pictures of her all beaten up entered into the courtroom.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I hate cops. I mean, to me, they're all assholes.
Me like, too, sir.
This cop tried to lock me up on trumped up charges one time, and I was so mad. I felt like saying, "Man, like, I felt like saying fuck you." And I felt like I thought about punching him in the
no.
But I thought if I did, then I'd probably end up. They would lock my ass up for a long time.
You'll be on the news.
What's the story, man? That sounds like a good story.
Well, I got to fight with my sister one day, and you know. Instead of beating her ass, I just thought about getting revenge on her by calling the cops.
Oh.
Oh, and then why did the cops arrest you?
They
always arrest the guy, man.
Yeah.
They didn't arrest me. He just made a threat. He just said, blah, blah, this and blah, blah, that. How dare you try to get a revenge on a woman? And I'm like, man, fuck that. I don't care if she is a girl. She tries to fight me. If she punches me in the face, I'm going to knock her out. I don't care.
So you're saying they did not arrest you?
No, but he threatened to arrest me, though.
Oh, man. Well, I mean, you should probably never hit a woman under any circumstances. So you made the mature decision, but of course the cop doesn't care.
He didn't care. He just wanted to, I mean, he just wanted to get on about his business and whatever.
Yeah, isn't it great? We pay their salaries, but they seem to have a problem every time we need them for something.
Yeah, and he threatened to put me in a jail cell and said, oh, if you want to, don't make me put you in a jail cell with Ramirez and stuff and all that. Because you know how jail, the way jail works is if you're of a different race, you have to fight somebody else who's of a different race. So he basically threatened to put me in a jail cell with a bunch of Mexicans, and they would have kicked my ass because I'm a black guy.
Yeah, man, sorry. Cops don't seem to like black guys much. It's a real, I don't know. It's a growing, ever-present problem.
Yeah, so on a lighter note, what's your favorite bad movie?
I haven't even seen a good movie in so long. I have no idea.
Well, my favorite bad movie has to be Joe Dirt. I mean, it's terrible.
I remember Joe Dirt. It's a pretty fun one.
It sucks, but I like it.
When the dog's testicles are stuck on the porch and he can't get out or something. I remember that.
Yeah.
It was like David Spade's, like, when he was known as the jerk.
Oh, yeah.
David Spade is the jerk, and now he's kind of like Rob Schneider. Everyone forgot about him, where he just moved out of the movie industry.
Yeah.
It's kind of like Bubble Boy with Jake Gyllenhaal.
That was a bad one. Yeah.
It's like they had these very situational, kind of cartoony, comical movies of the 90s. Those are all pretty funny.
What about Freddy Got Fingered?
Love Freddy Got Fingered.
That movie was hilarious.
Because that one, it was Tom Green, you know, literally driving a car, stopping, then sucking a cow's udder, then going back in the car. I know. There's a lot.
And it turned out to be like a male cow or something like that, and that it was a milk. It was bull semen.
Oh, okay.
Bull semen. There's so many good parts in that film. I mean, you could talk about the iconic parts. I always loved when I was little and I saw that film. I loved the cheese factory. I'm the cheese head. and he puts cheese on top
of
his head.
One thing about comedy is I noticed as I got older, I'm a lot pickier about comedy. When I was a kid and a teenager, and even in my early 20s, like, I could watch any comedy film and I could pretty much laugh, but now it's like I'm more jaded.
Yeah, I really like that Judd Apatow thing that was happening a couple years ago, but I thought that his movie, like 40-Year-Old Virgin and stuff like that, was kind of like a nice mix of comedy and storytelling, but he seems to have blown his load too.
I remember the 40-Year-Old Virgin, and I think I saw it once or something, and I just have a weird memory of it. This one time where I think there's a scene where the girl's going to give him a blowjob with the braces. I found that pretty hot.
Oh, yeah, that was a flashback.
I like that.
All these comedy films, especially romantic comedies, are either totally formulaic, or they run out of new ideas, so there's all these like remakes of stuff and sequels.
Oh, did you ever see Pootie Tang? That was funny.
Pootie Tang. Adventure Kid, have you seen Don't Be a Menace to South Central While Drinking Your Juice in the Hood?
Yeah, that's stupid.
I love that one. The movie
where he, like, used a nuke. He somehow got a hold of a Russian
nuclear bomb was going to put on the cops. Yeah, that movie is so great. There's so many grids, and then there's just, like, there's a lot of good scenes in that movie.
Do you know Louis C.K.?
Yeah.
Louis C.K. wrote Pootie Tang. Do you know that?
I didn't know that, no.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, and the funniest scene from that movie to me is when his father somehow got mauled by a gorilla in a steel factory. It's just so random.
I mean, I'm trying to think of some other films that I like.
Talk about Louis C.K. Louis C.K. is funny because he always goes around depressed, and it's a situational comedy. I mean, a lot of these comedy films, when you have two people acting silly together, that doesn't really work.
What, like Chris Farley, David Spade, or something?
I mean, I was a fan of them as a kid, but I just think that's just too cliche.
I
like Louis C.K., I like Larry David's Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Yeah, did you ever see The Marin Show? His show is good.
No, I haven't seen that.
It's on Netflix sometimes. But he's cool. His show is funny.
Yeah, well, a wise man once said that the root of all comedy is suffering. So when I was a kid, I grew up watching cartoons like Rocco's Modern Life, and when you think about it, it was pretty dark because Rocco always suffered in every episode.
Yeah.
All those shows,
especially the theme of a conflict or a misunderstanding, that too.
I can't imagine letting kids now watch Ren and Stimpy and those shows that we grew up on.
No, I mean, today they watch. I don't know. I think Adventure Time now is this strange. It's 6 years old now when you think about it. I think seven going on, and now every cartoon seems to be a rehash of Adventure Time. The only thing it seems like cartoons now are basically they grew up with millennials or something, and now it's like if you watch Star versus the Forces of Evil, it seems like, are you sure everyone's in their like mid or late 20s? These are not 15-year-old kids. It's like it's about West Coast culture, and it's really like indie kind of. It's like Portlandia.
Well, I haven't
stuff.
Seen it, but I remember you did a review of it.
Yeah.
Huh. Well, I guess all the writers now are probably like the people who all grew up with Ren and Stimpy and those shows are probably all 30, 35.
You told me that you're starting to watch the original Twin Peaks.
Yeah, I just last weekend there was on Netflix and it was raining. So I was like, oh, I never watched Twin Peaks before. And the show's perfect, man. I don't know what I was doing or how the show ever got canceled, but it's perfect. It's a great show.
Yeah. Scott, have you ever heard of Pete and Pete?
Yeah, man.
It was kind of like a kid's version of Twin Peaks.
A kid's version of, I never heard.
Wait,
of
I can. That's wrong. Actually that's pretty accurate. I can see that. No,
yeah, they're remaking. They're getting back together to make a special reunion show.
Of which show, Pete and Pete?
Pete and Pete. Yeah, both the actors are coming back to make a special. This, I think they already made it or something. They're just gonna premiere it in like August or something. I've seen
well,
that.
Well, so far, every reboot I've seen has sucked. Like, the Arrested Development one was not good.
Oh, yeah. I think most of them do. Twin Peaks is actually the one exception. Of a successful reboot, but most of them do suck.
Well, they better do a good job with Pete and Pete. That's one of the best shows of all time.
You know, for some weird reason, in the 90s, there were a lot of magical realism shows. You had Northern Exposure, you had Peaks.
I fucking hate Northern Exposure, but okay.
And then did you ever see Outer Limits?
Yeah, I like Outer Limits.
All right, I've never seen it. Fat Mike from NoFX sings about how cool it was.
I've seen it, but a long time ago.
Okay.
Did you ever see Tales from the Dark Side?
Yeah, I remember that.
Nah.
The only reboots I've been watching and that I actually are quite enjoying is the new Samurai Jack reboot, and there's actually a Mystery Science Theater 3000 new season, and I think they're quite enjoyable. They're just, but yeah, it's like there's this weird, like...
Is Mystery Science Theater the one with the puppets critiquing films?
Yeah, the new one has Felicia Day in it, and...
I haven't seen that since I was a kid, but I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, you do it every 3-4 years, and there's this new one out, and it's on Netflix, and I've been really enjoying that. I find that watching old movies while watching other people watch movies is quite enjoyable, probably before the dubs, you know, when they did it on YouTube, but I find that a classical charm that won't go away.
Are they critiquing movies now that you've seen? Because like the
no,
old
ones,
they're
still old. They're still old okay, French cool. movies. That's the...
perfect.
We were talking about politics. What are your thoughts on the whole concept of an alt-left?
I guess we could speak freely on this podcast, right?
Yeah, go ahead.
So I think that the alt-left. Needs to happen quickly, needs to get as organized as the alt-right, needs to have the weaponry that the alt-right certainly has, and because it's scary. One side is really prepared and really motivated, and I mean, there's a racist cord in this country. There's a cord that hates helping people of any color. And I think it's really scary that we're getting to a point where, like, robots are going to replace 50% of jobs in 5 years. And the people on the right are the people who go, like, you know, I don't want a handout. I don't want any help. But those are the people who look at their neighbors and go, I definitely don't want them to have any help. And, they're going to have to be combated, man. It's not – this isn't going to go away peacefully. You know, that congressman got shot the other day. You know, I don't know how you can be trying to kick 24 million people off of healthcare and then you take a bullet and the media tries to get everybody sympathetic to you.
Yeah,
so,
well, Mr. Scott, I mean, I don't know if we're really ready for a civil war. I mean, because let's be honest here. None of us on this podcast have ever had any type of training or know how to shoot a gun or fight any. Well, I fought a couple of people, but that's
yeah. But that's part of the problem. The other side has all of that.
Yeah, that's true. They do have guns and training. We don't have anything.
What's up?
I don't know if it will be like a full-on civil war, but you are seeing. I think what we'll see is not a civil war, but like full-on, but. A lot of political violence comparable to what happened in the 60s.
Yeah. It's just they've made such a mockery out of voting. We have a president now who doesn't even pretend like he cares to, you know, to represent the interests of anybody but his small group. I mean, so what are you going to do? Everybody, oh, we'll vote him out. Like that hasn't worked. It hasn't worked in decades. It's not, we're past voting people out. They've gerrymandered this country to the point where I don't even know if Republicans can lose anyway. You know, they're winning all these pop-up elections without even having an agenda or a platform. They're just winning because they're Republicans and they've rigged up all these districts so they can't lose. So what do you do when voting is made a joke? Like you're only left with one option.
With this whole concept of the alt-left, the thing is different people have their own versions of it. It actually originated with the blogger Robert Lindsay, but then some people are saying Rabbit's alt-left, he calls it the left wing of the alt-right. And then there's a kind of generic definition being put out that's just like Bernie Sanders supporters. Then Fox News and Sean Hannity are saying the alt-left is like Black Lives Matter. So all these people, there's all this like there's all this confusion about what is the alt-left. But the origins of it really go back. It was founded by that blogger, Robert Lindsay.
Well, the government is obviously a really dangerous enemy, and they have no morals and no scruples about doing anything to anybody. So I don't think there's going to be a civil war between the right and the left. I think eventually these two sides are going to realize that the bigger enemy is the government. What that is going to result in, I have no idea. But I even remember with Occupy that the NYPD would dress up a cop in like a Giants sweatshirt and put on like a, you know, like a trucker hat and send him into the park. And then this guy would be like, hey, you know what we should all do? We should all get together and go beat up those cops. So you could tell that it was a mole, obviously, because you could spot a cop from outer space. So then everybody would throw things at him and, you know, whatever, yell pig, cop, and then chase him out of the park. And he would go back and stand with the cops. So if they're even attempting to do this kind of deception for a couple thousand kids in a park, I mean, they'll do whatever. Sean Hannity's going to sit up there and give misinformation about the alt-left, you know, as long as he has a job.
Venture Kid, how would you define the alt-left?
Well, that's a difficult question, but I'd say we're kind of... Who would I use as a good example? Christopher Lash. Christopher Lash was a socially conservative Marxist, so I think we're pretty close to where he thinks.
I was thinking more of alt-left in terminology that... if you think about the alt-right and how it came about, it was more kind of rejecting the old right of, you know, the Hollywood Nazi or the Nazi, you know, the Hitlerite image and making it more accessible and more getting foundational ideals. I think the alt-left is kind of like, well, you're a leftist because you believe in certain ideals about human freedom and about this kind of... and you believe it's almost like a philosophy, so you have to weed out the garden of what is this established left that has caused problems, you know, you could say like radical communism or some bad form of socialism, and just weed that out and fight for the basics of, I've said this before, friends, family, freedom, if that makes any sense, but I think it's an umbrella term and a social network of people that like the left and want to save the foundations of left, but they don't want to be associated with, like, the whole SJW thing or, like, the decadence, what's going on to be considered to be left-wing.
Yeah, that's kind of how it got started. The alt-left was primarily opposed to a lot of the extreme SJW culture, but a strong emphasis on economics and rejecting like neoliberalism and the Clinton establishment of the Democratic Party.
Well, it's just that end of the Democratic Party doesn't represent anybody anymore. If you have that much money, for the most part, you're a Republican or a conservative, and everybody else is further on the left than the Democratic Party. I mean, they can't lose they can't win an election anywhere. The guy body slammed the Democrat in Montana, and he still won. It's like nobody the right knows who they are. And they cater to that. The left has no idea who it is. But we're all further left than the Democratic Party. If you're on the left, you want free health care, or single payer health care, and you want to go to, you know, school should be affordable and all this other stuff. Like that's more extreme than the Democratic Party.
Adventure Kid, what are your thoughts generally on the alt-right?
Well, here's my thing. I don't like the racism. Bothers me. But at the same time, if a alt-righter wants to start his own ethnostate filled with white people, I wouldn't really care.
What got you interested in the topic? Because you follow some of the blogs.
Well, I've always kind of been a contrarian.
Oh, yeah, a contrarian. Or would you say anti-establishment?
Yeah, I consider myself anti-establishment. I don't like the establishment very much. Like I said, I'm a left-wing Marxist.
anarchist. I hate big business and I hate big government. I can't stand them both. And I don't like monopolies either.
All right. I agree with everything you're saying, man.
No, I was going to ask Scott, do you know about the, I think there's going to be a free speech rally in Washington, D.C., and it's going to be, there's going to be this, I guess, conflict, you might say. Do you know about this? I think it's this Sunday. There's a protest.
No.
Oh, you do not? Okay. It's basically, I'm going to go to that, and supposedly people like Richard Spencer and some of the, you know, major figures of the alt-right, and as well some, I guess you could say, the Antifa. There's just going to be this big protesting block happening, and so I'm just going to go as kind of a reporter, or at least going with a couple of friends to see what that's up. And that's at the Lincoln Memorial happening up there. But
wait, which side is it? Antifa sponsoring it or the alt-right sponsoring it?
I think it was an alt-right thing happening, but in these protesting things, other blocks show up. And it becomes this, you know, a free-for-all of left-wing versus right-wing.
And definitely.
So everybody pretty much shows up. So I don't know what to expect, but I'll see what's up on it.
The problem is we have a government that doesn't care. I mean, almost the entire country can believe in something, and the government doesn't care. So you have a rally, you know, and like... What this is what always happens. There's going to be a fight between the left and the right, and the cops are probably going to arrest more people on the left, and our president's not going to, you know, he's not going to tweet about it, or he's going to tweet that there was no crowd there.
Yeah, you've got a point. It's like my friend Keith Preston once said, when it comes to fights between the right and the right almost always wins. I mean, because let's be honest, who's more likely to win in a fight? Some country boy from Alabama, or some middle-class kid who's never even seen the inside of a jail cell.
That's true. I've never won a fight in any protest I've gone to.
What was the recent protest? Have you ever been to a recent protest recently? Or?
You know, I haven't really been to the last, like, violent... when I was in L.A. for the Women's March. I marched there, obviously, but... just at Occupy, the level of violence I saw the cops take it to was just unbelievable. The fact that nobody got killed by the cops is a miracle. I mean, they would single out the weakest looking girl and then just punch her in the face as hard as they could. And it wasn't even, this is all filmed. You know, people, this was on YouTube. People saw this. It's just, and the excitement the cops got from hurting kids was crazy. So after that, I was just like, there's no, you can't beat these people with protest signs and ideas. Like you have to go, because they'll always win. They have the law on their side, they have the guns, and they have the sympathy of most of the people in this country. It's not, you're not, they'll just hurt you for fun.
Yeah, what I'm afraid is that this is gonna blow up. I don't know if you've ever seen footage of the 1968 Democratic Convention when the police and protesters fought each other in the streets.
Oh, the Chicago riots?
Yeah.
And where the whole city was like on fire and everything.
Yeah. I think in Occupy, if the cops had been using because cops now, they have sound cannons, you know, they have these things that shoot out vibrations that just, you know, make your brain scramble until you fall in the street. They have sandbag shotguns. So they don't need to kill you. They could just hurt you really bad, you know, and then arrest you. I think people would have definitely been killed had this been on 60s, you know, tactics.
Oh, yeah, man, the 60s, back then they didn't have tasers or anything. So if you charged the cop, they would just shoot you.
Yeah. Well, that was the thing with Occupy, too. There was none of that. Nobody in my entire time there, I didn't see anybody attack a cop. I saw cops spit at people. I saw cops use every racial slur in existence at whoever they were looking at. I never saw a protester hit first. They tried, but they tried to bait the protesters. I didn't see that happen one time.
Do you think there will be a revival in Occupy Wall Street? There are these protests against Trump, but my concern is that the movement will just be more focused on Trump as an individual, but the issues like Wall Street and income inequality that Occupy address will be neglected.
I think you're probably right. And, you know, we can get into like how Illuminati is this, but it seems like they have Trump go out and say or do something ridiculous, you know, and then everybody's freaking out about that. And then they repeal the Clean Water Act, or they, you know, skirt something through the House without anybody noticing because Trump said something ridiculous on his Twitter. So I think that's probably where we are more. Even with Occupy, it's like it was a direct result of them, of the, you know, the world banks collapsing. The government sucked trillions of dollars out of the middle class economy and handed it to the banks. And who showed up to protest? Like 40,000 kids in college, like no parents, no middle class people, you know, in unions, no firemen, none of that. None of those people showed up. So I don't know what it would take. I mean, those are people watching their children's futures get destroyed, you know, watching their vacations for the next 20 years disappear. And it still wasn't enough to get them out in the street. So I have no idea what it would take.
Yeah, that reminds me of the song by Frank Zappa called Mother, Mom and Dad, like where the lyric of the song that struck me the most, and he was talking about the 60s riots. Frank Zappa, he said, you know, is the parents watch on television as the cops beat the children, and then they were, and then they say, you know, they can never be my child, and then the cops killed her, their daughter too.
Wow. I never heard that song.
It's a good, it's a very powerful and moving song. You know,
yeah, it's pretty heavy.
During the 60s riots.
Huh. Well, all right. Frank Zappa already said it best. I don't know.
We are at the end of the show. Scott Lodotti, do you want to plug your upcoming poetry book one more time?
Sure. It's called Yeti Funeral. It's going to be out in October on Kuboa Press. My novel, Play the Devil, came out from Kuboa Press about 6 months ago. That one's on Amazon. The future one will be on Amazon. And I'm on Instagram at Scott Lodotti.
Scott Lodotti, it's been an excellent show. Thanks for being on.
Yeah, thank you guys. It was nice meeting you, man. I'll see you on the next one.
And also, thanks, Pillator and the Adventure Kid.
It's nice talking, like you're always.
All right, see you guys next time.